Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, December 18th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 122. We are in the final stretch to the holidays. We are heads down on end-of-year content, hashtag content. I am Austin Walker. I'm being joined today by Danielle Riendo. That was her laugh right there.
That was my laugh. How you doing?
Good. I'm doing all right. There's construction, so could be better, but what can you do? Also joining us, Rob Zachney.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Rob Zachney, who just wrote a story about sad Christmas music.
Yeah.
Extremely on brand. And also, of course, Patrick Klepek.
Are you saying you're against infrastructure investment? What the fuck, Austin?
Oh, this is not infrastructure investment. This is like a company building a new thing.
So
this
burn
is
it
private.
Down, capitalism! That's it.
They have been working on the streets, and that has been annoying, but like you said, it's infrastructure. I'll live with it. The streets need work, you know? But I just feel like it's a shitty time of the year for it because of how cold it is. And I always just feel like y'all must be freezing your asses off, like digging up this road right now. I get you have to repair roads even in the winter, but it's just, I feel bad for people. I hope they're getting paid.
I think
well.
That's fair. They wear like long underwear and Under Armour and then like work clothes. Cause I've had like several car accidents with like as an EMT where I've had like construction workers like as my patient, and like you got to cut through all that, so I always feel really bad because I'm cutting through like four sets
of
clothes.
Yeah.
It's like all their stuff, and I'm like, I'm so sorry, I have to do this to make sure you're
they
okay.
They probably understand.
They do. I mean, they're usually
it's like
not happy
that or be hurt really bad or worse, so I think you're still doing your job, you know.
I know I just feel bad, man. That's
I get
shit,
it
you know?
I get it.
But what you're saying is, like, Under Armour is not, in fact, like, body armor. Like, it will not protect from injury.
Oh, no. I think I just blew up Under Armour's spot right there. Sorry, UA.
Who will protect this house if not Under Armour? God.
No.
Jesus. I feel like
I can take that pair of underwear out of the window.
Oh, no.
I feel like Under Armour, like, kind of was one of those companies that went from a weird upstart brand to something that's everywhere very quickly, or we're just getting old, and it happened, and so it feels like it was yesterday, but really it was like a decade ago when they really came on the scene, and this is just part of getting old.
Well,
yeah, no, they did. Like, when I was playing lacrosse in college, and that's, like, early aughts, that was the thing to have for, like, under your uniform kind of thing. So they were starting up, like, around then. I think you're absolutely right. Like, it was only, like, a little more than 10 years ago, and now it's, like, every human being is wearing Under Armour all the time.
Well, and this thing is, like, it really did start out as, like, clothes, like specialist clothes for like athletes and such, right? Like, and compression shirts like are awesome if you're like, you know,
they're great.
Playing outdoor sports or, you know, even for weight training and stuff like that. But I think in the last 10 years, the other thing, and partly driven by Under Armour, is like athleisure became really trendy.
Yeah,
the idea of like, I'm not active right now. Right now I'm sitting at my desk, or I'm draining the last of like the coffee in the office kitchen. But I'm wearing clothes that suggest that, like, basically, like, your clothes became the I'd rather be sailing bumper sticker. It was like, oh, man, I really wish I was mountaineering today, but oh, well.
God.
Gonna be honest, I'm wearing Under Armour right now.
See?
Like, this moment. I'm wearing, several Under Armour things at
you legitimately moment. Could be getting up from your desk in 5 minutes to go out for a run or something.
I'm gonna lift today. Like, for sure.
See, this is it. You gotta be ready to go.
I'm ready to go.
Here's the thing that's really made me feel old this weekend is I went to go see The Last Jedi. I'm not going to talk about spoilers or takes or any of that shit. But what I am going to say is after it was over, one of the things that I was bemoaning was the lack of a Star Wars game that let me just kind of linger in the world of Star Wars, because Battlefront 2 is definitely... I jumped in briefly to Battlefront 2. That's not what I want right now. sorry, Battlefront 2. It's not. There's bits there that I think are kind of cool, but, like, no. The thing that a friend of mine reminded me of was that it was 22 years ago that the first Dark Forces came out. It was 20 years ago that Dark Forces 2 Jedi Knight came out. And that's a long time. 20 years is a long time because I have such clear memories of, like, sitting on my desktop computer in our dining room in my home and, like, play and doing, like, online Jedi battles in Dark Forces 2, and it was 20 years ago. Anyway,
20 years without great LucasArts Star Wars games.
exactly. How's everyone else doing? So yeah, that's what I did this weekend. Was I played some Battlefront 2.
Did I?
Did you?
Yeah, I started it.
Okay, we don't have to go deep in this, but what'd you think of it?
I liked it way more than I thought I would.
Uh-huh.
But also, I like it just enough to be really resentful that it's not more of the stuff I like.
What's the stuff that you like?
So what you said about, like, lingering in the world.
Yeah.
Right? Like, everything about that game is so meticulously detailed and, like, created with such care down to the fucking, like, material textures on, like, rebel officers' uniforms and stuff. Like, It's holy shit. Like, they used every possible reference to recreate the world of the original films. That's fantastic. And then you're sort of rushed through it on rails because it is a DICE like shooter campaign where you're literally having these different, like, tableaus flashed in front of you that suggest associations, but you're never really allowed to linger in them.
Uh-huh.
And I'll give, like, a perfect example. So Inferno Squad, right? Yeah. The entire, like, the game opens with, and it's really clever, like Inferno Squad needs to make sure the ambush at Endor happens. So you're unwittingly assisting the end of the Empire that you serve.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. But I really found myself wishing that the game lingered on that a little more. Like, yeah, let me be a member of Inferno Squad for a little bit and let me, like, understand who they are and their mindset before it all gets ripped out from under them.
Yeah.
Like, that moment where the Death Star explodes is a cool beat. Even at that time, it feels a little bit rushed. But the thing that makes it feel really rushed is that literally we met these people, like, 2 minutes ago.
Right.
And now their world's been, like, turned upside down. But it doesn't feel like my world has been turned upside
down. That is the entirety of that single player. Like, that, if you go back, like, the piece I wrote was basically, like, you had the pieces, and then you didn't give the pieces long enough to
breathe. Yeah, I think the pieces are all really cool, and I think that the performances are also all totally fine. It's like, even good. Like, I actually think that the lead character is, like, well acted in the scenes that I've seen so far. I like the message that is received early on, like the final message that kind of sets up the next steps for the remains of the Empire. I like that sequence a whole bunch. But, like, it's what you're saying, Patrick, which is, like, it doesn't feel like there's any breathing room for these pieces to actually sit and develop.
Yeah, it's a game that needed to be, like, twice as long as what it is, and I think there would have been something, or like, the story it was going to tell needed to be, like, squashed in a way. Like, I mean, what happens is, like if you continue to play it, Rob, is just, like, the moments where, like, the game could have given that breathing room are then used to, like, ah, shit, you need to go hang out with Han Solo,
right?
Or, like, you need to go, you know, hang out with some other character that is clearly them rotating around the cast because they want to show you that they've got the main characters from the Star Wars movies. And it's just too bad because it feels like I can't speak to that game's development very much, but, like, from the outside looking in, it seems like the kind of thing where the team that was assigned to make a single player did their job, and then the constraints put upon what they, like, the story they were allowed to tell seemed like just completely diminishes a lot of what could have been, like, a really interesting story in that world. And instead, you're just left with a bunch of, like, oh, that could... Like, the feeling at the end of it is, even with the DLC, they did some epilogue DLC that came out last week that I went through, and it's the same exact thing. Like, on paper, if someone was to tell you, here's, like, what they're playing with in this little epilogue, you're like, oh, wow, like, that's fucking neat. Like, I could see how that could be interesting. And then, as it turns out, it's just, oh, well, it's, like, you know, an hour long, and it doesn't give the emotional beats. Like, they really go for the emotional beats in both the original story and the epilogue. It's just not long for it to have any impact.
Right. And it's just, like, it's frustrating seeing Ragtag get, you know, seeing that movie and then coming to play Battlefront 2 made me even more frustrated that Ragtag didn't pan out. However, why ever that didn't work, it was a frustrating thing to see that. And then just like, I want there to be those single player experiences in that setting, because so many of the things that work for me in Star Wars happen on the margins. And this is like maybe the defense of the huge game. Like I've often been the sort of person like, no, give me the 6 hour, give me the 3 hour game. I would take an Uncharted length Star Wars game, right? That sounds like it would be good. But then I actually think through what this actually came up in a conversation I was having on Twitter last night with Sean Elliott, who is worked on Prey, actually, Arcane Austin.
Safeway alumni.
Safeway alumni, Sean Elliott. TFW Fair. Radio's own, the Brodio's own Sean Elliott. About how what his takeaway from Last Jedi was, and I don't want to get into, like, I'm not going to get into spoilers, I'm not going to talk about specific takes or whatever, but one of the things that he said was that, like, the film for him didn't spend the time to work through some of the issues it brings up. And it made me think, unsurprisingly, of Knights of the Old Republic 2, and that I don't think that the writing in Knights of the Old Republic 2 is the best writing in video games. I don't think that it does the best job ever of, like, it's not that its A plot is so much better than everything else in the world. It is partially it's a game of a certain size that allows for enough beats to in which characters can be well developed, in which these complex ideas can be revisited over and over again, and so your relationship to those ideas and those characters is given the space to change and develop, and you sit with them. And there is something to be said about games as the medium with which you sit, with which in a movie of 2 hours long, in a, I mean, maybe TV is also the same medium in some sense.
I was
right?
going to say that I think that's why you see, like, these days, a lot of films are actually becoming 10 episode television shows.
Totally.
Like, even in Star Wars itself, like there were a lot of component parts about Rogue One that I enjoyed, but man, you know what, Rogue One would have been awesome, like a 10 episode like Netflix, HBO
about,
special.
Because think about the development that someone like Saul Guerrero would have gotten, the Forrest Whitaker character in Rogue One, over the course of 2 or 3 episodes, where you get to watch that character go from who he is in the first beats of that movie to who he is when he returns in that movie, and he doesn't get any of that. And instead, that's like one of my big problems with that movie is both with him and with the lead character
Janeway.
Thank you, Danielle.
That's
Captain
her name.
Janeway. with her, you also get like, oh, okay, she's this child, and then okay, she's now this other character, and you don't really see any of that development. And also, I don't really get a sense of her until pretty late in the movie of who she is. And yeah, I think you're totally right. Like a 10 episode, even an 8 episode run would have been so good.
So it's for anything would have been. I mean, it's really like it's the same frustrating problem where it's just like movies keep getting longer, but they can't get longer than. I mean, Last Jedi, which I haven't seen, but, like, it's already 2.5 hours. Like,
yeah, it's
really
already, it's long. It's
you're
long.
Stretching the, like, if your Star Wars movie is 2.5 hours long, probably it's something that should have been stretched into, like two separate arcs or like, certain stories.
No, this is, I'm here for a return to David Lean-style filmmaking. Like, I want the Star Wars movie that's like, you know what? It's 3.5 hours long. There's an intermission in the middle.
Oh.
Go get yourself some snacks.
See, I would do
that. That
sounds score. Yes.
That sounds
right
so good.
Remember when soundtracks had overtures on them? Yeah,
yes.
We got them. We brought it back.
I would do that in a second. I think this movie would have been better for that, honestly. Like, it would have sucked to sit in a theater for that for another hour and a half, probably, without an intermission. But it did need more world. I don't know. Who the fuck knows? Anyway,
so,
I don't want to. My point is, games are games in which one of the things I like about games is I can sit down and be with Baldur, the Zabrak engineer, for a 3 hour long dungeon in which, between the little bits of conversation I have with him and the banter that plays naturally, I get a sense of who he is in that moment. And then if that changes because he, you know, in very gamey terms, becomes more light side or dark side in the future, like I can have this real sense that I've sat with this character, that I've been with this character, and recognize the change that he's made over time. Whereas that does not always come through through in the 5 hour, 6 hour long shooter campaign. We're like, oh, I'm barely getting any characterization here. So like that is my, one of the things I've been thinking about in terms of games and storytelling because of Star Wars. So thank you, Star Wars, for putting that in my fucking head.
Thank you, Star Wars.
Hashtag thank you, Star Wars.
Thank you, Star Wars. What have y'all been
playing? I think we got an episode title today.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah. Well, Danielle, you just replayed through Night in the Woods, right? Through Night in the Woods for the first time?
I'm still in it right now, and I did not finish it previously. So I started it, in February when it came out on, PC or whatever. Mac, laptop. And really enjoyed it, but as always, not always, but as happens often, I was... pulled away by something else. It may have actually been Zelda, to be honest.
Yeah, probably.
Like, it probably was Zelda. And so I was actually really, really happy to get an Xbox One code and start playing it on console, because I actually think this game is amazing and beautiful on console, and that surprised me, because it's a very intimate game. It's a very, like, curl up with your laptop type of game. So I was sort of like, okay, I don't know how this is going to play. But it's... such a beautiful game with so many visual layers to it that it actually looks fantastic on a big screen. Like, it looks really, really beautiful to kind of run around the world of the game. It's sort of this beautiful fall, autumn tones kind of game about sort of small town life. You play as Mae Borowski, who is a really cute little cat, who's also a 20-year-old college dropout. She comes back to her sort of Rust Belt small town and finds, how many things have changed, how many things haven't changed. Her friends have kind of grown up and gotten jobs and had to be adults, and she's still sort of in this very adolescent mindset. It's a wonderful game. I really, really like it. I liked it when I first played it, and I think I like it even more playing on a big screen.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that game is maybe the best counter argument to what I was just saying about large games being the ones that let you sit with characters and setting, because I also haven't finished Night in the Woods yet. It's high on my list of things to get to before I write my top 10 list.
I think
which
it's
means
worthwhile. Yeah, I think it's 100%, worthwhile for that.
100%.
Yeah.
It is a disclosure. I'm friends with the two of the people on the team, Scott and Bethany. But I think it actually does do the thing of like letting you just spend time with characters. Like literally a lot of that game is, oh, I'm going to go spend time with Greg today. Exactly.
It's also repetitive, right? Like the game structure is like you go to sleep, you wake up, you pass through the same like five screens over and over again. I mean, there are moments where those characters go and to different locations, but like if you were to break down like a huge percentage of the game, it's a lot of just, oh, I wonder what that character is like. Time has passed and like the seasons are changing and you're checking in on this character and what they have to say or how their life is going along. And I like the first 3/4 of that game more than I care for the last fourth, but it is it has the best writing of any game this year would probably be,
I've enjoyed like I say wow because I actually think like games have been good this year, but you're
right. A lot of great games have a lot of great writing, but I guess that part of what I like the best like naturalistic writing, like it's there's a version of Night in the Woods that is smug shitty Twitter writing and it doesn't land at all, but they find a balance that like feels like very human, despite the fact that it's coming from a bunch of animals.
Right.
I think that's a really good way to put it, and it's also very. It's very realistically frustrating to play this game in a lot of ways because Mae is so immature in a lot of ways. Like I still have probably about another hour to go. I think I'm in that sort of last portion at this point for the first time too. So I'm experiencing the end game for the first time here. And Mae, like I just want to, kind of slap her a little bit sometimes. She acts like a kid.
That's harsh.
I know it's harsh.
I mean, she sucks, though.
That's the thing. She is a 20-year-old. Wow. Like, she's a kid in a lot of ways, right? And she's dealing with her
Treat
friends
your mom
have...
with a little more respect, Mae. She's doing her best.
She's, B, her friend B, is, like, dealing with some shit, and she's also 20, but she's had to grow up. Like, there are certain ways in which Mae is just really unaware of how kind of well she's had things in certain ways, and of course she's also dealing with a lot of emotional issues. There's a lot of Mae that I want to slap her because she reminds me of me at 20. There's a lot of that in it, so I appreciate that quite a bit about this game. I appreciate that it feels realistic and that it's not afraid to be annoying sometimes. It's not afraid to make its protagonist annoying. I think that's kind of a powerful thing sometimes.
Yeah, totally. I think that's the thing I wish more games would be willing to explore, is like, okay, I'm not the like The thing that a lot of games do is have like a troubled protagonist or a protagonist who has like, I have a gray morality. Like I you know, I'm going through some shit. I have issues.
Sexy
man.
Anti-hero.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, that's not, no, like, because at that point I do want there to be games in which I'm like, oh, fucking please come to grips, like get it together, whoever. And I don't get that a lot in games. So yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. Anyone else playing stuff right now? I know it's end of year and everyone's trying to get ready for stuff.
Rob, I want to know what you think of Resident Evil 7.
Ooh. Oh, man.
Oh, right. Rob Zachney playing games that came out this year.
New games.
truly a surprise.
True story. To whet my appetite for this one and see how things have evolved, I was playing some Resident Evil 1 the other week.
That's better than playing 5 or 6, so...
Yeah, fair.
Chosen wisely.
But no, so I'm playing Resident Evil 7 in part because, once again, like, I basically stalk friend of the show Matt Wise's blog a lot. He's a games academic. He teaches at NYU, I want to say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's a very smart... and knowledgeable games critic, and he is sort of an aficionado of the Resident Evil series, and really, really admired Resident Evil 7, so I've been sort of meaning to get around to this one forever. And I find it really fascinating, because it is such a hard left turn from what I am accustomed to associating with Resident Evil, and feels a lot more like, okay, wow, like, the big budget games... have been, like, the big budget developers have been, like, paying a lot of attention to the quote-unquote, like, walking simulator and the Gone Homes of the world. Like, yeah, it owes a lot to PT, but, well, PT also owed a lot to games.
Yeah,
like,
sure, yeah, like, yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
And so this is very much like, okay, we did Gone Home Chainsaw Massacre. is how it feels, and... it fucking works. Like, it is... And there's just such a cool aesthetic quality to it. Because the game itself, the art style, the way it's lit, just, like, the overall, like, graphics, there is something, like, subtly crude or, like, unpolished about it. Like, the bloom effects are a little too harsh.
Especially if you're playing in VR. Like, that's even more the case because of, like, the limitations of, like, the PSVR fidelity. And it only enhances that aesthetic... touch that you're talking about, like when viewed through like a slightly crude piece of technology.
Yeah, like a lot of like B horror movies, right? Like a lot of like early Carpenter stuff and everything has a particular look because it's not being done with a huge budget and it's not being done with the most like modern or high quality equipment that was available at the time, right? You're like shooting on cheap film stock, basically in abandoned parts of whatever city is nearest. That's kind of the aesthetic of those films. This is the video game version of that. Like it is a game where the final like graphics passes were just like not done. So everything has this slightly like crude, off-putting, unsettled look. And it's really, really effective at just like creating this vague sense of like unreality and weirdness and revulsion, which is amplified by the fact that, like, this is one of the grossest fucking games I've ever played.
It's so gross. It's so gross in so many different ways. Like, the actual, like, surroundings are just putrid, like, especially in in every place I've been in that game. So I've been to the opening area, the kind of house, the main house, and then the area after that, which is also a similar rural house nearby. And both of those are just the grossest shit
I've never had a game trigger my gag reflex.
Yeah, a lot. That food sequence at the very beginning is
fucking God.
So gross, and I'm so glad I did not play it in VR.
I think that this is one of, like, I've so cooled on VR in 2017, largely because I don't think games have made enough of a case for, like, me dragging the cables out and putting that all together. Which is partially laziness on my own part, and I think partially an indictment of just like VR's inability to find experiences that are worth going through that extra effort when we live in a world where you have to do that kind of effort in order to play a VR game. And RE7, I think, is a fundamentally different game in VR. I think it's still probably an excellent game. I can't say that because I played 20 minutes in non-VR and played the entire 15 hours in VR. But I think they're fundamentally different experiences in virtual reality. And I think part of what I think is the great success of RE7 is similar to the great success of Breath of the Wild, which is that RE7, while a first-person game, essentially just reimagines what Resident Evil 1 was in a lot of ways. Like, when you go back to think, like, what did I love about Resident Evil 1? It was, like, exploring a weird, creepy, quiet house.
Excuse me? Did you say creepy?
I heard creepy.
I like that.
So, all right, Danica,
what is happening?
Danica, are you in the room?
Oh, no, Babby Pat's with
us.
I cannot do this.
Oh, no.
It was a weird, creepy house, and you,
what has happened
you see
to
it
my
as
website?
The zombies, and they go rawr.
They do go rawr.
They go rawr.
Welcome to Waypoint with editor-at-large Baba Walters.
God, okay, what is the creepy house?
Resident Evil 1 is exploring a quiet, creepy house, and Resident Evil 7 is the exact same thing. But, like, reimagined from a different perspective. Like, it, in the same way that Breath of the Wild, when you describe to someone what was it like to play the original Zelda, right? Like, knowing that, like, the technology is now crude, that, like, the mechanics are crude. Like, it's not going to work for... If you gave someone is just starting to play games now, it's like, play a Zelda game. Like, uh-huh. You gave Zelda 1, they'd go, fuck this. Like, maybe they can find it interesting, but they're not going to get the emotional arc that you had from playing that game. You couldn't do that with Resident Evil 1, even with the remake. Like, it's still a crude game with better visuals. RE7 gives you all the feelings of the original Resident Evil, imagined with, like, from a different perspective. And I think that's a huge part of the reason why both RE7 and Breath of the Wild are so phenomenal, is because they are both modern while also adhering to what made those original experiences so good in the first place. And that's what, like, a good sequel should be.
Well, and what Resident Evil 7 is doing as well is, and I've heard it changes toward the end of the game.
It's bad at the end. It turns into RE6 and shoot 'em up and
But in these early stages, at least, like, it's going back to what Resident Evil 1 was, which is, like, yes, you can engage in combat. Oftentimes, that is not the play. It's not going to, you know, that's not going to be the solution that you're hoping it is.
Right.
And so this is a game very much like Alien Isolation.
Ooh.
Where
I perked up right there, sorry.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You are not going to become, like, master of these spaces. Like, you are still being hunted on someone else's turf. And there's effectively, like, a bunch of different predators who all have their own different, like, attacks and hunting styles. And they can sort of just appear at any time. And they're all fucking terrifying, but, like, you literally can't fight them. They are unkillable. Like, it does not matter how many rounds you have for the pistol, that's going to do exactly nothing. And so what the game becomes about is, like, these frantic headlong flights from someone who's hunting you. Now, unlike the Xenomorph, I think these things feel like the enemies in Resident Evil 7 feel a little more escapable. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like running like hell is less something you do on your path to reloading and more like an authored experience, right? Like, you are forced to rush back through, like, a lot of times you're forced to rush back through territory you've already explored, and you're frantically, like, trying to remember, like, okay, this door leads to the main hallway, and then straight down the hallway, and then there's those steps, don't go left, go right. You're doing that as you're running like hell, and you can actually get away that way. Like, you know where certain hiding places are. And that's actually really, really cool, because in Alien Isolation, a lot of times it felt like, if that thing spotted you, you were fucked.
Right.
Like, that was it. You were done. Here, you're meant to be spotted, and then you're also meant to be, like, stalked and hunted. And it makes it an enormously difficult game to play, especially because, like, in addition to the, like, dread and anxiety, it's just really fucking gross. And so, like, it's the combination of revulsion and terror that make it tough to play for, like, long stints. But damn if I'm not really into it.
Yeah, my favorite tiny detail in that game is the grandmother who is in a wheelchair. And she is just she's randomized. She just appears in different places as you're exploring the house, and she doesn't do anything. Like, she just sits in the corner staring off into space in her wheelchair, and it is my favorite tiny because part of what it showed, like, it's a game, like, the difference between RE6 and RE7 are so stark because one shows no restraint whatsoever, and RE7 shows an incredible amount of restraint up until like the very end when they ramp it up in a way that I felt that didn't work for me. But like I saw what they were going for, like they tried to have an escalation arc, and part of what RE7's genius is those moments where, okay, what a lot of games would have done was to have the character in the wheelchair when you get near them to like pop out at you, do a jump scare, like do anything.
Right.
And instead, like, it doesn't do anything. And your imagination runs wild. You're thinking about it, like, especially like thinking about it in VR, where like you're walking past her and then you physically look behind you to see if she's doing anything different.
Right.
And it's an existentially creepy moment that underscores the restraint they show in that game. And it's a you're getting me all. Like, now, I had the game already on my top 10 list, but I'm talking myself into moving it up right now.
Well, did you check out the new DLC that just came out?
There's a lot of DLC. There's actually 5 major pieces of DLC that they put out for that game.
That's a lot.
And part of what I haven't had a chance to sit down with them. I kind of want to sit down and like do it all in one shot. Maybe when I have some time off next week. But part of what they did, which I think was smart, was that each of the pieces of DLC are thematically and mechanically different. And they seemed like they finished RE7 and then said, rather than just doing, like, just whatever they do for Resident Evil 8, rather than just, like, doing the traditional sequel, it's like, hey, in the DLC, like, let's do some weird stuff and see what lands. And DLCs involves a character from, like, a legacy character, because RE7 does, although it's a reboot in a lot of ways, it takes place in the timeline after RE6.
So, I did not know that.
Yeah. Huh. It basically doesn't ignore the mythology, but it separate puts it into part of the world where it can like safely ignore like a lot of the consequences of the convoluted mythology of Resident Evil.
Right.
And one of the DLCs that just came out, called Not a Hero, I think, turns it into an action game. Like, it says, all right, here's the flip of RE7. Like, we're giving you all the guns, and actually the enemies are like fucking scared of you because you're going to be going through and just mowing them down. Another DLC takes place in sort of like an escape room, and you're like trying to get around traps. So like they do some. Oh, I'm excited cool. to go. I've heard a lot of it doesn't work, but sure. I'm glad that like that was the tact they took.
Yes.
Was like let's be creatively interesting. Let's try different stuff. It makes me like I don't know what they'll do with RE8, if it'll be a first person or they'll go more traditional. But they have a really interesting team in place that.
I almost like these.
With that series.
I'm reading about these now, and there's almost like a game jam like feel to it. Where it's like, oh yeah, we could just try turn this one into a shooting gallery. Turn this one into, like you said, an escape room. That's really cool. Awesome. Now y'all are making me want to go back through. Like I'm through the first section of that game. I'm past the first boss, and so it's like I know I could see the rest of the part of this game that's really good in a night of play, probably, you know, and get to the part where everyone is like, and then it kind of falls off the rails. But so I might try that. I might add it to the list of things I need to revisit. I need to just take a day and just turn off the internet and just play video games to make sure that I've touched all of the games that I need to before we kind of settle into the rest of our end of year stuff.
Oh, so you're gonna bang out Divinity: Original Sin in the deck?
Real talk, I played that game for like 6 hours, and I know how I feel about it, which is maybe a contentious thing to say. I don't love that game. It's fine. It's fine.
Did you like the original?
Not as much as other people. And so I think that combat system is really cool. I love the stuff that happens there, but the tone is just not my tone. And that's like, I'm not judging anyone for whom it works, but it just doesn't work.
That would
for
be
me.
Curious because the original game, the combat is what got me through like the 70 hours, because I liked that it was broken. Like broken, but it was like it let you bend it in a way that was really fun and creative, most games don't do that. They put rules in front of you and you got to play in the rules, and that's fine for lots of games, but it was cool to play a game that said like, you can fuck with us a little bit, like,
you can fuck around. That stuff is totally in. I think you will still have a really good time with the Original Sin 2, and I'm excited for you to do it.
I got really tired at how awful the story was by like the last 20 hours. Like, I was at this point in the original, I put in 50 hours and like, all right, like I want to see this through, like I've done this, like I want to get to the end. I don't know, like, especially knowing that this one is even longer.
It's long.
Like, people have told me, like, it's a Persona 5 sort of, like, 80-hour investment if you want to see it to the end. And it's like, I don't think that the combat, as cute as it was the first time around, I don't know that I could do that a second time. I still want to try it, given how much I did like that game.
And there's stuff there that I think is conceptually really cool in the story stuff. Like, I think that there's a lot of stuff that's, like, really unique for fantasy. Like, I think a lot of the pieces are fascinating. I want to be in that world, but I kind of want to be in that world taken a little more seriously. And I'm not like a fantasy. Fantasy is not my favorite genre, but I like, the humor that is presented often just doesn't land for me. And also, like, I think I am just, I've said this before, that despite growing up on isometric RPGs, I have gotten away from them in terms of presentational style in a way that means I have to be in a certain mode to even want to be in those games. And that's a shame for me because I'm missing experiences that I know, that I know are good. Like, I haven't played the new, like, the follow-up to Planescape this year either. Tides of Numenera. And I know that that is a game I would probably enjoy because I really liked the original Planescape Torment. I'm just like, nope, I have not put any time into it. I think part of it is just big games like that already require a big ask for me in terms of time. And so on top of that, having this extra layer of difficulty for me to get back into games from that perspective and where I'm reading a lot of text and where I'm not able to multitask, it's hard. And that is actually, again, I think it's a personal failing, not a failing of these games. We should take a quick break, actually. We will be right back.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This has been such a weird year, because it feels like a few years ago, a Planescape sequel would have been like, full stop, like, holy shit, this is the year a new Planescape dropped.
Yep.
And good games are coming so thick and fast right now that, like, what's happening is these games that I think were meant to sort of, like, reawaken love for these, like, niche genres or niche franchises or... They didn't used to be niche, but they kind of became niche as you know, the industry grew, but their market share didn't. What's interesting is it feels like, once again, like, the Planescape sequel has basically fallen into the same trap that the original Planescape did.
Right.
It was like, oh man, this is really great news for people who love this shit. But it didn't. I'm not sure it really broke out into the broader conversation. In part because it is just much harder to do that now. Like, everything I heard is that it's a pretty faithful and terrific, like, you know, follow-on to the original Planescape. But unfortunately, everyone is really busy this year, and there's a lot of, like, must-play experiences. This is no longer the event that I think it would have been a few years ago. It doesn't get the attention that, like, the new Wasteland did, for instance.
Right,
I'm not sure, but I'm not sure if Wasteland 2 came out this year, I think it would have had the same... Like, Wasteland 2 is like a very specific moment in time. I don't think that would have gotten the time of day in 2017.
Well, Wasteland 3 is coming, right? So
I think they're also promoting Wasteland 2 to Switch, which is that's smart.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Go on.
2018, the year we play all these games on Switch.
Yes!
Right, like, maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
I hope so.
God. Wasteland 3 was 3 million it raised on Fig. So, 3.1 million. Is it a sort of situation?
Well, no, because the way Fig works is sometimes it comes in with already like $1 million in backing.
I see.
You know,
because it comes
in with investment backing. And I do think Wasteland 3 was a case of, it did raise a bunch of money from fans, but I don't hold me to this, like, stay out of my mentions, but I think... I think that came in with, like, investment up front, which inflated what it seemed like that game.
Yeah, I see.
Oh, shit. Patrick.
Yeah.
Are you in my mentions? Write for an end of your trend piece.
Mm-hmm.
You need to write something with the title, Bringing Us Some Figgy Pudding.
Yeah!
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I'm giving you that one for free, son.
You just hold on to that, Patrick. We'll talk later. Don't worry about it. Other things. Are there other things to even mention in terms of games at this point? I feel like
it's very briefly. Did anyone play that Gorgoa game?
I haven't.
I've got downloaded.
I put 30 minutes into that game back at PAX East of 2017, and so I've played the beginning of that game through.
Do you want to explain what it is?
Yeah. It is a puzzle. It is a hard game to explain. It's called Gorgoa, Gorogoa. I believe that that's right. No, that's wrong.
Goro Goa.
Is it Gorogoa?
Goro, like, yeah, like Goro. Goro the monster.
Like Goro.
Goro.
Goro. I have four arms.
Yeah.
And then Goa, like, hey, can you Goa to the store and pick me up some milk? I'm out.
That's how Mario says it.
It's me, Mario. Yeah. Can you go to the store and give me some milk? We haven't had milk in 3 days. What am I supposed to do? Drink black coffee? Come on.
Correct.
It is a puzzle game. It just came out on Windows, Switch, and iOS, in which you play a boy who is trying to get these like four or five pieces of colored fruit, and who is exploring an environment through a screen that is kind of broken up into four panels. It's like horizontal and vertical four panels. And as you move from panel to panel, the world can, you can do things that change what is in the other panels, or you can kind of teleport from panel to panel. So like at the, like, I'm going to like be very, very, very basic at the kind of description of this. So imagine you are in, the four panels are just like a room, like a living room, basically. Or it's like a bedroom up top right, and then the bottom part is the living room. And so you go through a door on the top right, and you come out into the living room that's on the bottom right. And then you go over to the left, and there's a window out into a city. And then you click on the window, and it reframes what's there from being the living room to being the city in the background. And then this is why it's so impossible to do. It's so hard to talk about what this fucking game is, because what you end up doing is doing things like, okay, you've zoomed out into the city street, and now there is a building, and then you notice that in the other part of the living room there is a painting that matches up with the city street in the background. So you zoom in on that right, that bottom right tile where there's a painting, and it now makes, instead of just being part of the city street, you have a whole city street. And now maybe there's a cart that you can move from the bottom left pane into the bottom right pane, and then you can zoom back out on both of those, and on the painting that cart will then be there, and now you can move the boy back over there and somehow get him the fruit that was in the cart.
Sounds amazing.
It's, yeah, it incredible. It's gorgeous. It's like, has this very painterly style. It's almost a sketchbook style, actually, now that I think about it. It feels like it was done with like colored pencil or something. It is like, just watch the trailer. It's like a minute and a half to get a vibe for what I'm talking about. It is one of the strangest games I've played. I love figuring out the logic to it. I love thinking about how the different parts of the different layers can interact. There's a very storybook quality to it, and I don't only mean in terms of the art and the kind of simplistic nature of its storytelling. It's a very kind of, Cameron Kunzelman actually just wrote about this for us, about the, you know, it's a game that is about death and war and all these things, but they're kind of hit at tangentially. They're hit at through art and through design and kind of the events, but not through like a long narrative or like an explicit narrative. But I also mean it has a storybook quality in that it feels like I'm turning pages, and it feels like I'm finding almost like a pop-up book, finding little secrets hidden inside of the pages, and almost also like a storybook in the sense of it feels like a classic, you know, fairy tale or a classic collection of fairy tales, almost, where it feels like there are layered narratives that go into each other over and over again. So maybe you need to get a MacGuffin of some sort, and the way to do that is to open up a book in the game or to look at a photo in the game of an old sea captain, and so then somehow you end up being transported into the world of the sea captain, and then from that sea captain somehow you end up transported into the world of a scientist in a different city, distant and, you know, far away, who's working on a new type of barometer or something. And it's all visual. There's like very little, if any, spoken language. It's all pictographic, really beautiful sketches. And it's like unlike anything I've seen in the last, it's unlike anything I've seen, period. And again, it's out on Switch, iOS, and Steam now. And I think for a pretty reasonable price. I think it's like
12 bucks.
Is it 12 bucks right now? Yeah, it's 12 bucks.
15 normally, but it looks like there's an end of year sale through the 4th.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, through January 4th on PC, it's $12. So that was my experience with it, again, 8 months ago. My understanding is that the developer, Jason Roberts, who designed it and illustrated it, I don't know what the total credit, like, staff size was on it, but I know that the designer and illustrator is Jason Roberts. I've heard that he cut out a ton of stuff to make it a very tight, focused experience. I've heard people say that some of the stuff he cut out was actually really good, but that it just didn't. He has said, like, it just didn't fit into the flow of the game I wanted. So I'm very excited to play something that has such a tightness to it. Again, hard game to describe. Yeah. Hard game to describe, but very much worth your time. At least look at the trailer and see what the fuck I'm talking about, because otherwise it sounds like nonsense. So there's that. I really want to play that for sure. And again, I want to play that on Switch.
Yeah, well, I've heard that it's a little weird on Switch because it's kind of a point and click interface, and the controls are a little awkward.
Interesting.
Switch. We played Battlegrounds, and one of the big updates that they added to the game since we last played it was this replay function.
Right. Yes.
There are two things the game has added as it's headed towards 1.0, which happens in 2 days, I believe. One is they added a kill cam, so that after you die, once your squad is down, or if it's solo, you can discover it immediately. You can see from the perspective of the person who killed you, you can see how exactly you die, which is like very useful both in like giving you closure like a particular encounter, and also useful because it allows you to see different tactics that people employed like in taking you out. And so the thing is that doesn't let you know what happened to like your wider squad, or like what was happening on the map like sort of writ large. And what replays do are allow you to see exactly that. So like we had this moment in our stream this morning where we stumbled upon this house kind of like halfway up a mountain that had some crates and items that there was no clear way to get up there. There was like a spot in the house where like stairs should have been, but they weren't there, either on purpose or it was an oversight. Who knows? But just as we were going to give up in trying to scale the top of this, either Danica or you, Austin, came up with the idea of, I think it was Danica, said, bring the car over and maybe we can use the car to like to leapfrog higher on this building. And we managed to do that, get up on this building. And this building was just like a perfect fucking spot to just, we're like, because even if someone wanted to use the car to get up where we were, like we were just
it was
wonderfully
perfect.
Positioned.
It was so
and
good.
The circle was closing in, like, right, like, where it was going to be a coin flip on whether the circle, like, landed, like, basically right on top of us. And we just would have been in a really incredible position to, like, make a real stand against, like, whoever was left over. And what ended up happening was, you know, as it goes in Battlegrounds, the circle closed on the other side of, like, a road. Like, basically, there was a road in between
going
these two areas.
Down a hill, basically. And there was kind of, like, an upper left and upper right, a lower left and a lower right. And it closed such that upper left, where we were not, was the highest point on the map. And so we went from upper right to lower right, and then that just didn't go great from there.
Well, yeah, it pushed us out, and there were only six people left, and it made it very easy. You don't know in the moment, but that seems very likely. Those are like two squads with like either one person down or not a full squad, which is common on the test servers where all this is happening. And we pushed out, and like basically when it gets down to that low, like it's often positioning that is going to win the day over good shooting. Like that's not universally the case, but like in this specific instance, like they were very good shots, but
they were very good shots.
What happened was that like we pushed out hoping that we would run into them, and we were basically running into a field, and then all of a sudden just sniper fire just came railing down on all of us, and we tried to hide, but then there were just clearly shots coming from another angle, and we all just like just gone in an instant. And while we knew what happened, we died from sniper fire, like that's not incredibly satisfying. Like you want to know, like, could I have done something differently? Like was from the moment like the shot was fired and it was all over from there. And what the replay function lets you do is see everything. You can scrub through a timeline of your entire round up until the moment that you died, and you can jump between anyone on the map.
You can even go free cam. You can even totally have a camera detached from people, so you can get that really great, like almost picturesque shot of the landscape of, okay, there are these three people moving across the... It's the same functionality as if you've seen a spectated custom game, the one, mm-hmm. like when we did the Jeff Grubb one, stuff like that. It's so cool. It's so fucking cool because you get that whole bigger picture is kind of what you're gesturing at, right, Patrick? Like,
yeah.
You get how they got there. You get the right. feeling of, like, what their overall positioning is. Not just, oh, yeah, they shot me from up high. You get, oh, I couldn't have done shit here. Like, we were just fucked. Like, we were just
And that's what happened. Like, that's, yeah. And that's what actually made the match more – It made it more satisfying because, like, what you saw was when you scrubbed over to those to the other squad, it was three people way up on a ridge, like, yeah. As the circle was close, they were moving to the same spot we were, but whereas we were running through an open field with no cover, they didn't have any cover either, but they were coming down a mountain able to monitor us and had three sniper rifles.
Right.
And what you ended up seeing was that, like, the guy who took out Danica, because Danica was the first one to go down. I guess I shouldn't say the guy, the first person to take out Danica, did so by, like, immediately zooming in, tilting to the right, like, using a lean function in a way that wasn't them fucking around. They were using it because it was easier for them to take the shot, and then immediately taking the shot, and just Danica goes down.
Just,
like,
instantly.
And then they immediately start... And then they did that to the rest of us. Like, it wasn't single shots, but they were taking the kind of shots that, like, these fuckers know how bullets drop in this game in a way that, like, I don't and I never will.
It was also just a nice thing to see. One of the things that Battlegrounds has had a problem with over the last couple of months, and they're starting to curb it now, is people who used outside tools to, like, have aimbots, basically, so that they always hit. And being able to watch someone shoot at me and miss as I'm moving back and forth, actually, before they finally pin me down, was this relief in a weird way. It's like, yeah, I got beaten. Like, I got beaten there, and that's totally fine, and it's so cool to be able to just know that. Or the other thing is, like, as a learning tool, and I know this is all just such old, like, Rob, you must be squirming in your seat. Even you, Danielle, as someone who, like, watches sports, the notion of, like, oh, yeah, when you watch replays, you get to learn things is, like, such, I know, a basic thing, but it's so cool to see it in a game that we've actually put time into. Because the other thing that happens is you go, okay, here is what we did right. Like, when they should have killed us way quicker, or they could have killed us way quicker if we had gone out the north side of those houses where we didn't have cover. And instead, we did make the right move as we came through the different, like, row of houses. We went on the south side of the house when we could. And then also, what could have we done differently? And the answer is, actually, we could have gone further south down the hill, which would have broken their line of sight. And it's like, okay, we just weren't reading the geography. We weren't thinking. We never stopped and said, we said, like, oh, where could they be? And what we said was, like, oh, probably to the east, which is not enough. Like, you don't, that's not how you win championships. You know, you win championships by thinking about elevation. You win championships by thinking about specific moves. I was just like, oh, I'm gonna go up and lay down near the road. No, that's not a winning strategy.
I have an end of year PUBG question for both of you, for both of our you know, PUBG,
for Crowbar and Sickle.
You know, for Crowbar and Sickle. Sorry, I forgot what your nicknames were. I apologize.
That's fine.
It's Monday. How high up is this game on your GOTY list? I need to know.
It's high. It's high.
High up?
Me.
It's
okay.
Yeah, it's high. Like, at my top three are, like, a shifting... My whole list is a shifting sands because I...
Yeah.
Like, as I illustrated with RE7 and as I, like finished Doki Doki Literature Club, which I sort of wish I had finished in 2018, so I could have just put it on my 2018 list instead, it's, like, got me thinking, like, well, what game do I need to knock off? Like, I'm wrestling with people sending me links to a tweet that I wrote in January of this year, in which I specifically told myself, hey, Patrick, don't forget how much you liked Gravity Rush 2.
Yeah, no, yeah, I had that thought. I had that thought yesterday.
Someone dug it up and, like, linked it to me and then emailed me the tweet to be like, don't forget, you piece of shit. Like, they didn't say that, but they were insinuating that.
Yeah.
And I've had that, like, I will say, currently on my top 10, Gravity Rush 2 does not exist. It's in, like, if I was a top 15, it would be in that top 15. Because this is one of those things that, like, is actually useful about the conversation that I just had with Rob about RE7. Like,
yeah.
this happened. Like, there's a reason they call they release Oscar movies in December,
right?
Is because there is like first impression advantage to certain games. Some games, like a Breath of the Wild, like transcend that, but lots of games, and Gravity Rush is like a perfect example of that type of game, which like would end up on could end up on a lot of people's like 7, 8, or even just 10, where it's like, I want to give Gravity Rush 2 its due. Yeah. It's going in 10. But it loses a lot of... what I end up doing is I end up thinking way more about this, like, the last, like, 8 hours of Gravity Rush 2, which weren't nearly
which
as good
not,
as,
that
like...
That final act is not the best part of it. I think the thing that I started writing in my mind what my Gravity Rush 2 entry would be if it makes the top 10 list for me, and it's like... It's one of the worst openings I've played in a game in
the
recent
opening
history.
And closer are
and the end
terrible.
Is like just so rushed and bad. But the bulk of that game, and I think I don't think it's the final 8 hours. I think it's like the final five, like that final act,
whatever that final act,
that final chapter is not good. But so much of that game is so great and warm, and the soundtrack is so good. It's like So it is fighting for that number 10 spot for me right now. Like it is its claws are out. I'm gonna listen to the whole soundtrack today, and I think that might be what it needs to push me over.
That in Hollow Knight, which is like I've not put enough time in. Like there's five of those games for me right now that are fighting for number 10, where I'm like, God, I love this, but I didn't play enough of it. God, I love this, but I didn't play enough. Maybe we should do a top 12 this year. Maybe we should
maybe we should all do a so we've been thinking about what the podcasting should look like for us next week.
Yeah.
One of those episodes should be games that are not making our top 10 list, but that we wish we could include.
Yeah.
And we're not saying it's our number 11 necessarily, but.
Watch that one go off the cliff as we begin talking ourselves into changing our top 10 list on the spot. Like, wait, what am I doing here?
Well, so I'm having the opposite thing with actually a game. Rob, you and I streamed this, which is this is a game that's coming out that came out in early access super recently, and I'm having the thing of like, well, if I don't include them, I'm having the Doki Doki thing, Patrick, which is like, I've already played it, so does that mean I have to consider it for contention this year?
Yeah.
And the answer is no. These are all made-up bullshit awards. I can do whatever the fuck I want. But it's a game called Star Traders Frontiers. I'm not going to go deep into this. Because also, this goes completely against the thing I was just saying about not being able to deal with like certain kind of old-school UI constraints. It's called Star Traders Frontiers. It's from a group called the Trusse Brothers, a studio. They spent years making super crunchy, like very systems heavy mobile games that were all like, it's lots of programmer art. It's lots of which is a quick and easy way of saying that the art is made by people who maybe are not artists first. Often has lots of heart, but not a lot of like technique. They made like weird like 4X games for Android phones and complex, you know, systems heavy RPGs for phones. They finally are making games on the PC, and Star Traders Frontiers is this like systems driven, you know, it's a Star Trader game. It's like an Elite or something, except that it's also sort of a Crusader Kings 2, in which there are factions that hate each other, and you're gaining reputation. You kind of play a star captain who has their own ship, and you're you know, doing various activities. You could be doing spy work. You can be hunting down pirates. You can be a trader who is just trying to make money by moving stuff back and forth. You're gaining reputation with individuals and with factions, so it might be the case that this, you know, this one house whatever loves you, but this one guy inside of it really has it out for you. And like, it's just like exactly my type of shit, and I'm really enjoying it. It's in early access, which means it's not all of that stuff is there, but it's been out since November 14th, which is not that long, and it's had 14 updates, meaningful updates, not just bug fixes, but like, all right, this is the third update this week, and it has had, you know, and this time we're adding new ships, and last time we added the whole new story, you know, feature or something. It's been really cool, and it's go watch that. If that sounds like your type of shit, go watch me and Rob get up to some hijinks as we investigate the destruction of a space station. It's on our YouTube now.
It's a really interesting game. Like, it's one of those...
Yeah.
Like, you get out of it what you put into it.
100%.
Is 100%. Like, if you are willing to buy into the story that's being told and sort of the, like, the way it feels like a little bit, there's some semi-procedural storytelling happening around you, but then there's also, like, main plot stuff.
Yep.
If you're willing to invest yourself in that and, like, sort of do the, like, for me, like, for instance, Sunless Sea was an enormously evocative game. There's not much to that, but, like, it suggests and evokes a lot. This is a lot more, like, systems heavy, but at the same time, like, there's also all this flavor around it and this feeling of, oh, there is, like, I am now, like, you know, setting foot on a stage of, like, palace intrigue and international strife. And you're just staring at, like, a lot of different tables and charts and, like, measuring out your fuel.
Right.
But it's all in this context of, like, you're involved in the, you know, Game of Thrones of space, basically.
Yes, totally.
And it feels good if you buy
it. You're a small player, but an important player. Like, that is what it makes you – that is totally how it feels. It's like – I don't think that this game is going to be the thing where you rise to become emperor of space. I hope it isn't, right? But instead, what you're worried, the things that are, like, motivating you is, like, okay, I'm going to make sure that I have somebody with the skill that makes it so that when we go to jump to hyperspeed and we fail the roll, the hyperspeed roll, they have a skill that just says ignore your first failure to a hyper roll speed within this 3-week period or whatever. It's, like, super crunchy, by which I mean there's lots and lots and lots of layered mechanics and skill checks. And, you know, as you're just flying around space, there is a chat log style thing that, or like a kind of a game, like a stat, an event log, that is just constantly saying what's happening. And so it's just like, oh, so-and-so failed their engineer check. So-and-so passed their piloting check over and over and over again. And it's a lot is happening all at once. But if you just kind of let that wash over you, make sure you have, like, a cool crew and you kind of get to know who your characters are, that's so good. And like Rob said, like, there is a degree of flavor that just so entirely works. There was a bit where we were trying to decide which space clan to be part of, and, like, one of it was a space clan where they have,
God, they were so good.
One of them, I forget what I'm trying to remember what the distinction was. One of them, they're just, like, these ridiculous fatalists, right? Which is, like, they have, like, survived so much, they believe that everyone is just whatever, like, their genetic memory is. And there's a great quote in the kind of codex about them, which is, like, you will not bend the Zenrin. You can try to break them, but Zenrin never break, so your only choice is to kill them. It's like, yep, good, I know exactly what this is. And then the other clan that we were up for was, like, Clan Steel Song, which, again, just, yep, entirely my shit. And it says, the men and women of Steel Song are courageous, self-sacrificing, and known to be intimidating. As a people, they profess a belief in reincarnation and that the ethereal spirits of man are reborn into new lives after death. So far, this is, like, pretty normal shit. And then it goes, among some of the Steel Song assassin cults, it is said that their agents do not kill, but simply guide their marks to their chance to be reincarnated into better lives.
Wow.
If their targets have lived an honorable life, perhaps they will come back as a Steel Song. It's like, fuck yeah,
oh,
so
God.
Good. Yep. It's hard to tell if this is a satirical joke or a serious feeling. Yes, exactly. Good. And, like, I want to spend time in that world, even though it is, again, like, it is not a pretty game. I think there's, like, there's some charm to the like, ship design and the character design. Actually, I think is actually really good. I think there's some fun fashion, space fashion in it. But it is not. It is, like, such a rough. It is such an Austin and Rob game. But like Gravity Rush 2, it is it's one of those games clawing for my top 10 spot. And it's just, there are so many games out this year.
I'm afraid of games like that. I'm genuinely afraid of games like that, because I'm afraid I will dive in, I will put 600 hours or some, you know, I will start living in this world. This will be my hobby. Like, I'm always terrified of, like, an all-encompassing game like that. Always. I'm scared.
It would be so, like, especially in a year where we've already lost so many hours to games like Zelda. You know what I mean?
And Prey. Like, for some of us who spent 100 hours in Prey, you know.
I briefly just want to say I've been playing Death of the Outsider. Dishonored 2 Death of the Outsider.
God.
Also clawing its way into my list, I think, probably. I don't want to give too much away there.
Okay.
It's super good.
If there's going to be a constituency for Death of the Outsider, then I'm going to...
Rob, you should play that game.
It's my number 3. I'm not afraid to say it. It's way up there.
I'm liking this. Yeah. I'm liking this.
Right, I can put that list together in my head now.
I played Tacoma.
Tacoma? Also a game I need to play.
Oh, shit, dog, you need to play Tacoma.
Yeah.
Like, no, but did you like Moon?
I loved Moon. I loved Moon.
You gotta play Tacoma.
You gotta play Tacoma.
Patrick saying, on Tacoma.
Yeah.
It's good.
I didn't say it was bad.
You said,
Here's what I'm saying is, in the context of, you have, like, what, a week to work some stuff out. I don't know. It's short, right? So you could do it in
That's
a sitting, right?
That's the thing.
But
there's so much labor politics in that game, though, Austin. Like, that game is about labor politics in space.
Well, and about the future that's being constructed by Silicon Valley.
Yep.
And,
okay.
Like,
3 hours. I can put 3 hours aside. I'm going to put 3 hours aside. I'm going to get through it. It's going
to happen. I disagree with Patrick's cicada noise.
I still need to finish it, to be fair. I still have an hour left. But I really like it.
That's not a good note. That's the note against. That's a note in favor of Patrick's. If you haven't finished it, and it's 3 hours.
Well, that's because of it's 2017.
Every character's a space lesbian, Danielle.
I
what
know.
The hell?
Believe me, I love this game. I just need. It's one of those where I put 2 hours in. I was at work, and then something else at work took me away from it. It was a work thing that took me away from it. So it's not my fault. It wasn't another game.
God.
Like the record to show.
Let the record show. Let the record show.
This all is right. Good. You definitely want your game of the year lists to be assembled as we all just gorge ourselves at the table of games, yes. Just frantically.
Absolutely.
It's a true holiday season special, you know?
If not that, then what, you know? all right. I think that's going to do it for us. I think that is... About what I was going to
go
to the question bucket.
You know?
Yeah, but I got to go play games. I actually have to eat a sandwich. I can feel my energy seeping away. All the coffee is disappearing in my bloodstream. Here's one quick one that came in from Dan in the question bucket. If you have questions, you can send them in from to gaming at
you can send them to this place where we won't answer them.
It's been a weird couple of weeks. I would say for us in Waypoint for reasons public and private in terms of like having time to answer questions.
Yeah, we'll do another. We'll do another maybe like at the start of the year.
Yeah,
we'll do
big,
another like
a big dive.
Question bucket dive.
That'd be great. This comes in from Dan. I recently went through my old games and found my copies of old Infinity Engine games and Goldbox D&D games. This resulted in me dropping all of my current games, Wolfenstein and Tyranny, for a good week or so. So my question is, which classic games do each of you end up going back to the most? And I'm curious if there is one game for each of you. Also, Dan asks if Patrick ever got to check out Plan Escape Torment, quote-unquote, which I guess is a thing you must have said at some point.
I have no history with that game, so I looked at that word and was like, I said what the word, what I thought it was.
It happens. Is there any game you go back to ever that is like, here's the game, I want to put some time away, you know, like in the middle of, you know, maybe when you're not busy trying to scramble for end of year stuff, is there something that's like, this is the thing, either genre or game?
Drop 7.
Drop 7 is actually
and,
a pretty
like,
good
puzzle
answer,
games in
honestly.
General, honestly, like yeah. good, like just a good puzzle game where I can just put my brain there for a while, but Drop 7 is probably my like perennial game. I will never not have that on my phone as like a anytime, anywhere, any place. I got some Drop 7 for myself.
Nice.
Yeah.
Rob?
Oh, man, there's tons. Like, literally, if anything reminds me of, like, hey, Alpha Centauri is a game that exists, I'm like, oh, shit, Alpha Centauri exists.
Right.
And then, like, I go and I play a game of Alpha Centauri. You know, I'm always, like, I return regularly to Company of Heroes, 1 or 2. It's something that... It's pure comfort gaming. Like, it's a system I know. I really, really admire it. And it's just, it's fun to return to again and again. I mean, there are so many. Like, look, I'm the person who got dragged like crazy a couple weeks ago for playing old games. Like, this is uh-huh. what I do. It's always the past here at Shay's Acne. The past isn't even past. So that's how I approach games, and it's all pretty good.
That sounds good. For me, it is a few games that fit into like the canon, the Austin Walker canon, and none of them are surprises, right? Like, I've started new characters in Dragon's Dogma twice this year. Every 3 months, I go back to Far Cry 2 for 4 hours or something. But I never commit to playing through those things, right? I don't do a full playthrough of those games. I just like, okay, I need a palate cleanser. I need to go back to something where I already know what I feel about it. And I put a couple hours in, and then I like, okay, good. I'm good. I'm out. Everything's great. And that has been fun. Like, I'm glad to have those games. Invisible Ink, also one of those things where like, I'll do a run once every 6 months or every 6 weeks or something. But I'm not going to, like... I don't, it's like, okay, I'm in it now. And I think that just reflects how I play games also to some degree, you know?
I don't do any of that. I have always forward. Time that it's always forward. Like the kind of reporting I do, like my job demands that it's always forward, and that like I would feel too like guilty like over replaying something old unless it was like for. Like in service of something, or like you know, it was part of a. If I was doing an oral history of a game, like that's a reason to go back and do something like that. But by and large, I pretty much always press forward. Battlegrounds, like I have speculated that maybe that could be that kind of game, but also, I would be able to justify it because there'd be stories you could write about that game,
and we'd be streaming it. If
that wasn't the case, then I would have stopped playing Battlegrounds.
Welcome to the world of content.
Well, that's my Patreon, World of Content.
Totally.
The woke world of content, right there.
God. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for us. Again, if you have questions, you can send them to gaming@vice.com. I'm trying to make sure it doesn't sound like gamingadvice.com, which is a different...
That's my second Patreon. Gaming Advice.
Gamingadvice.com. This is like a slot machine website, so don't go there. You find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Patrick?
Find me at the world of gaming.
In the world of gaming. Great. Danielle, how about you?
At DanielleRI on Twitter.
And Rob Zachney.
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.com.
Awesome. And you can find everything we do over at Twitter at Twitter.com/Waypoint. You can find us on Facebook, Facebook.com/WaypointVice. And as always, you can come right here to waypoint.vice.com to read all of the stories that we do. Look forward to what we're doing in the next, I guess not this week, but next week. Lots of end-of-year content, very similar to our package last year. Not very similar, because I think it's been such a different game, a different year for games, and because we're trying to do some extra stuff that we didn't do last year, so look forward to that. Because of that, we're going to be a little quiet this week in terms of stories on the site and in terms of streams and stuff. So if you don't see us this week, it's because we're head down on stuff for next week. So apologies in advance if you were like desperate to get a morning stream from us every week this week. You will also get a Friday podcast from us though, so look forward to that. As always, thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. All right, I think that's going to do it for us. Until Friday.
Be good and be good at it.
Koga.
That's a cat. That's Danielle has a cat now named Koga.
You just
Koga.
Got her attention.
Did what? Really?
She's sitting on my
really?
Lap.
She heard my.
So.
I love Koga. Cats. I love cats, so I'm going to let this one slide. Cute. Peace.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.